All right. Tonight's Torah portion is another one of those really interesting ones with lots of good stuff. Also, lots of things we've heard before, but get repeated because they must be important. It's called Re'eh, and it begins in chapter 11 of Devarim, or Deuteronomy, verse 26, and it says, Re'eh, an ki natan le panechem hayom. And in English, behold is that first word, re'eh, or see is how sometimes you'll see it translated, or maybe in the more modern parlance, just, hey, check it out! I set before you this day a blessing and a curse. Let's finish the sentence and the thought, and we'll come back to several of the interesting nuances in this one. The blessing, if is one way to put it, or that is how some renderings will put it. A blessing, if you will hearken, remember that word, Shema, hear and obey, unto the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka, the Lord your God, which I command you this day, and a curse, if you will not hearken unto the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka, but if you turn aside out of the way that I command you, instead to go after other fake gods, even demonic is how some translations want to imply there, other so-called mighty ones or Elohim, which you have not known. This sounds a lot like a number of things we've seen. This idea of the choice. I set before you this day, life and death, blessing and cursing, is from Deuteronomy chapter 30. Here is almost a bookend to that. We're seeing something that sounds real similar. But it's the behold and the first sentence there that probably bears a little bit of, shall we say, deeper examination. If you hadn't heard it before, I think this is kind of interesting stuff. I set before you, Re'eh, this day, a blessing and a curse. And what is pointed out here is that this word Re'eh is singular. This is talking to an individual, you. You check out, you see, you behold, you witness this fact. And then it says, I set before, and I'm going to put it in Southern English so everybody gets the understanding here, I set before you all this day a blessing and a curse. So what the sages point out correctly is, look at this. This is kind of strange. He tells people in the singular conjugation first, you look. You, each individual, look. And then he says, I set before you all this day the blessing and the curse. And that has been interpreted to mean, and I don't have any argument with this at all, that the requirement to look and to behold is an individual requirement for all of us. But that the blessings, and in particular the curses that follow, are set before us, I don't like the term, but I'll say it, communally, as a group. And this has been interpreted over the centuries to mean we have an individual requirement, obligation to hearken and obey, but that it is as a community that some of these things will befall us. And I guess maybe we can see that playing out again today too. And then there's this. This is another one of these Rashi-isms. The word here that is the blessing if you shall hearken really isn't the normal Hebrew word like im that would mean if. And even though a lot of English translations render it that way, it really is probably more correct to say the blessing that you shall hearken unto the commandments of Yahuwah that I have commanded you today. Now, in the Rashiisms, in other words, the Hebrew scholar that points out, hey, there's a subtle distinction there. It's really kind of neat. The blessing follows on condition up front that you do this thing. And I've used this example in years past, but I'll repeat it again in case folks haven't heard it. You can, for example, talk to somebody and you can set out a similar sounding contract and use two different words. So how about this? I'll give you $100 if you will fix my car. Now, most of us would understand the English to mean, okay, when you have fixed my car, then you have earned the $100. If you fix my car, then following the fixing, I'll give you the $100. But how about saying it this way? I'll give you $100 that you will fix my car. Well, I think, again, most of us would say, I'm going to give you the $100 now on condition that you fix my car. But you get the $100 up front. You see the subtle difference? In other words, what this line is saying is the blessing comes first. Our Creator loves us. He's going to lay the blessing out right up front. That, on that condition that you shall do, what you've really, if you think about it, already agreed to do, hearken, shamar, hear and obey the commandments that I'm commanding you this day. And then it says the curse. And here it does use the word eem. If you don't hearken, don't listen and obey to the commandments, and instead turn after these other gods. So you get the blessings up front. The curses, they may take a little longer, but they'll follow if you follow after other gods. 29, the verse 29 says we're going to talk about putting these blessing upon these one of the two mountains, Gerizim, and the curse upon the other one, Mount Ebal, Har Ebal. Aren't they over the other side of the Jordan, going down towards the west, the going down of the sun in the land of the Canaanites? You're going to pass over the Jordan, says Moshe, to go in and possess that land which Yahuwah Eloheka has given you and dwell in it. And the end of the chapter tells us one more time, you are to observe, to do, on a bet, that's the word shamar again, all of these statutes and ordinances, hukim and mishpatim, which I set before you this day. Now, this, too, is something that I know we occasionally have new folks, so I'll repeat it, because it seems like one of the things that I just, not a week goes by, I don't hear this half a dozen times. Torah means law. Not really. Again, it's not a horrible translation, but it's not a really great translation either. Torah means instruction. And when our Creator wants us to understand that certain things are statutes and judgments and commandments, well, then He'll tell us, and He will use those words. We just see a couple of them right here. So there are certain things that are commanded. There are other things in Torah in His instruction. None of it's passed away. Not one yod or tittle has passed away. But there are other things in His instruction that have to do with judgments. In other words, with teachings. How are we to interpret? How are we to really act and walk out His statutes and judgments and commandments? And finally, we have other things too, like stories, parables even, metaphors, things that help us to see how the big picture fits together. It's helpful to know about the patriarchs and their lives, what they did, how they walked in obedience to Him. And we can draw conclusions and further kind of hone our understanding, our instruction by means of all of that. All right, chapter 12 is one of the probably meatier portions, particularly when it comes one more time to this idea of adultery, idolatry, in all of Scripture. And it begins, like some of these others have of late, these are the statutes and the ordinances, ha-chukim ve-ha-mishpatim, which you shall observe to do in the land which Yahuwah is, the God of your fathers, is giving you all the days that you live upon the earth. Well, hey, does that mean if we don't live in the land, we don't have to do these things? I guess the question is, do you want to live in the land? Do you want the blessings? Do we understand that He's a loving Father? He's trying to teach us some things. And yeah, we're going to talk about a few things tonight you cannot do, really, because we're not in the land. Doesn't mean we shouldn't at least learn about them a little bit, I will suggest. But again, I do think these little subtle distinctions are important. I am not going to say that we have to do everything, because some of them we simply can't. One of the other things that when you see some of these statutes a little bit later on in Devarim, you're going to find there are certain things that apply to men, but not to women, vice versa. There are certain things that apply to kings, not to multiply gold and silver or wives or certain things like that. Again, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't maybe learn something from the things that kings are commanded to do. But as a general rule, we don't have the wherewithal to do some of that stuff. But it's helpful to understand these various instructions nevertheless. This one is also, I think, real helpful, even though we're not in the land, so we cannot do, at least in the land, some of the things that verse 2 is telling us about. You are to utterly destroy all the places wherein these nations that are being dispossessed, kicked out before you, served their so-called gods on the high mountains, upon the hills, and under every leafy tree. That imagery, by the way, sounds a lot like the places where we see the whoring that's described in Jeremiah 3 and Ezekiel 23, where Israel failed to do some of that and then fell back into the same trap. Verse 3 says this, "You shall break down their altars, dash in pieces their pillars, burn their asherim, their groves, full of these phallic symbol trees, with fire, hew down the graven images of their gods, and destroy their name out of that place." Now here's where I think another interesting little bit of Hebrew shows up here. First off, we got two verses that are making something, I think, about as clear as it can be made. When it comes to these things that are symbols and or places where these foreign gods are worshipped, get rid of them, hate them, abhor them, destroy them, dash them in pieces, burn them, hew them down. Some pretty graphic language. And it's even more interesting when you see it in the Hebrew. This is one of those examples that I'll give. There are a number of ways, and this is a little bit different too, but in Hebrew there are a bunch of different conjugations for verbs. Now we have similar things in English and in Spanish and other languages. You can conjugate a verb in the present tense, I do this, or in the past tense, I did this, or in the future tense, I will do this, or in maybe an imperative sense, you shall do this, or you can make it plural or singular, y'all will do this, or y'all did this, that kind of thing. And in the Hebrew, there's even an interesting conjugation called peel. I've heard it pronounced peel too, but I think it's peel. Anyway, and in this conjugation, when you put a verb that has a certain meaning in, let's say, the normal sense, and then you conjugate it in peel, it becomes more emphatic in a lot of cases. The example that I remember is, there's a verb, and I can't think what the verb is right now offhand, but it means to break something. And then when you put it in peel, it's the same root word, but now it means to smash it. All right? You get the slight difference? In English, we might just have different words. And in verse 2 here, it says, abed te abed, abedun. And if you notice, that's the same root word twice, and it's in the peel form in both cases. And this is the thing that gets translated to English. You shall surely, utterly destroy. You get the idea? All the places where these nations that you're kicking out of here serve their gods. And then in verse 3, we see all of these other dramatic action verbs, and they too are in the peel sense. You shall break down their altars, dash in pieces their pillars, burn their asherim with fire, hew down the graven images of their gods, and destroy their name out of that place. Exterminate, blot out, do away with, cut off, whack in two. Some interesting and graphic stuff. Again, you get the impression. This is something that well, most of you that have heard me talk for a Torah session or two understand, I think, is so important. And it's also important because when we look and see so much of the paganism that has infiltrated Christianity, unfortunately, so many of the things that people don't recognize, you know, from Easter eggs and bunnies to Sunday, Sun God Day, and all the other things that, we were told this is biblical stuff, and it turns out it is. But if you read chapter 12 in Deuteronomy, it ain't the kind of biblical stuff that we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be breaking down, dashing, hewing, burning, and destroying these foreign gods, not renaming certain so-called holy days after Ishtar, Easter, or Ashtaroth, and for crying out loud, not bringing their Easter eggs and bunnies into our houses. Are we in the land? No. Can we still anger our Creator by doing things that He has made it so clear in such graphic language, let's just say, is not pleasing to Him? Verse 4 says that you shall not do so unto Yahuwah Eloheka. Then it says this, there's going to be a place where He is going to choose out of all your tribes to put His name. And there's the place you're going to go. There's where you bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, all your freewill offerings, and the firstlings of your herd and of your flock. Eat there before, Yahuwah Eloheka, and rejoice. There's a great word, rejoice. Samach. Ever heard that word before? Ve samachtem. That's the y'all form. Y'all rejoice. Remember, have you ever heard the expression around the time of the feast? Hag Sameach? Recognize it? It's the same root word. Hag Sameach. It is that same root, and it means be joyful. Hey, have a happy holiday. Happy Hag. Or a rejoiceful holiday. I'll mention this now rather than come back to it later, but I just thought that was an interesting set of statistics that I saw, too. There are a couple words that Moshe uses a whole bunch in the book of Devarim, in his final instructions to the people of Israel as they're getting ready to go into the land. One of them is a word I just mentioned, the root, Sameach, that has to do with being joyful or just plain joy. And it's this Sheen Mem Chet root word. The other one you may have heard too. The other word is Ahav. Ahava. Love. Now here's the thing that caught my eye. Somebody has pointed out that if you go through the other books of the Torah, you see that, for example, Ahav, love, appears one time in the book of Exodus, twice in Leviticus, not once in the book of Numbers, and when we get to Devarim, 23 times. Cool. Similar thing for this word, Sameach, joy. Appears once in Genesis, once in Exodus, not once in Numbers, once in Leviticus, and 12 times in Deuteronomy. So between love and joy, we got lots of interesting stuff that is appearing, and those words too are in this portion, and they kind of give us a little bit of a contrast. How much he hates idolatry, adultery, spiritual adultery, and wants us to break down, destroy, dash in pieces all of these symbols of these other gods. Certainly don't bring them into our house, as we saw last week. But the place where he puts his name is literally the place where we are to bring our offerings and rejoice. Cool. All right, we got a question. I see. Should I take a job putting copper on a steeple, on a little phallic symbol? Okay, that's probably about as much as I'll say on that. Think about it, pray about it, and be guided is the best I'll do. I see some other comments on the screen, so all of that is good input. I'm not the one that's going to have to justify it or stand before him, and I don't know all the details of the situation. So I won't condemn someone else. I'm just going to quote what Scripture says and say, go and do likewise. I have no doubt that if you pray about it and read his word, he'll make it clear what he would have you do. By the way, verse 8, maybe has something to say about it. I'm just going to keep reading, see if it fits. Sometimes our Creator works that way. You shall not do after all that we do here this day, every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes, for you aren't yet come to your rest and to the inheritance which he's given you. But when you go over the Jordan and you dwell there, then he's going to give you rest from your enemies, so you dwell in safety. It's going to come to pass then that he will pick a place, and he will cause his name to dwell there. And there's where you're going to bring your sacrifices, your burnt offerings, your tithes. And again, Sameach. Rejoice before him. You, your sons, your daughters, your manservants, your maidservants, the Levite that's within your gates, even though he has no portion or inheritance with you. Take heed to yourself that you don't just offer your burnt offerings willy-nilly all over the place. I'm paraphrasing verse 13 there. But in the place which Yahuwah shall choose. And then do there the things that I command you. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't kill and eat flesh within all your gates after the desire of your soul, nefesh, according to the blessings of Yahuwah, which he's given you. The clean and the unclean persons may eat thereof, things like the gazelle and of the hart. Only, of course, you are not to eat the blood. You pour that out upon the earth. You may not eat within your gates the tithe of your corn or your wine or your new oil. The things that are tithes, no, you don't eat those there. firstlings of your herd or your flock. These are things that are to be set apart, like with the free will offerings. Eat those before Yahuwah in the place where he chooses, you, your son, your daughter, your maidservant, and so forth. So you, again, here comes that same word, Sameach, shall rejoice before him in all that you put your hand to. Take heed that you don't forsake the Levite either. Eventually, he's going to enlarge your border, just as he's promised, and you will say, I will eat flesh, because your soul desires to eat some flesh, and you can do that after the desire of your soul. But in the place in which Yahuwah shall put his name, if it's too far from you, then you can kill of your herd and your flock, which he's given you, as I've commanded you, and you can eat within your gates after the desire of your soul. Now, this is interesting, I guess, in fairness, since one of the things that that I am not real big on, I guess that's putting it somewhat mildly, is in general the concept of the oral Torah, insofar as people will say that some of these things from the oral tradition are commandments. I do not believe, as a general rule, that they are. Now, that doesn't mean I discount completely some of the wisdom that's in there. There are some pretty wise people that have said, hey, look, here's how you ought to do certain things. Here's how you ought to wear your tallit. Here's how you ought to tie your tzitzit. Here's how you things you ought to do and ought not to do on the Shabbat. There's some pretty, well, there's volumes and volumes of things on that score. I do not accept those as holy writ. They're not the same. If you, on the other hand, think that they have some great value and you want to do them, I'm not going to criticize folks for them either. The difference, again, is just whether they are commanded or not. Now, here's an interesting place. Now, this is a little bit of a Rashiism. At least he is one of the first that gets credit for it. Rashi predates a lot of the others. But you'll find that lots and lots of other sages, Maimonides, Rambam, and others, too, have built upon these things. If you know modern rabbinic Torah-keeping Jews, you'll find that most of them will accept the oral Torah. Anyway, so what I'm saying about verse 21 is there's an interesting case that is made that I want to give credit where credit is due concerning this verse. And this is a place where it says, if the place where Yahuwah is going to put his name is too far from you, then you can kill of your herd and of your flock, which Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has given you. And then it says this, as I have commanded you, you shall eat within your gates and after all of the desire of your soul. Now, what Rashi claims, and again, this is the kind of guy who's a Torah scholar I won't generally argue with. His claim is, look, see, it says, as I have commanded you, kill as I have commanded you. And he believes that applies to the method that basically gets called a kosher kill. And then you can eat after the desire of your soul. Well, he points out, hey, look, there is nowhere in the written Torah where this instructions for doing that is outlined. So when it says, as I have commanded you, what's he talking about? Well, see, they conclude he must be talking about the oral Torah. Because in the oral Torah, supposedly given to Moshe, there were instructions on that. So at least to the extent that they claim this is another one of these places, one of the few, really, that supports the existence and authority of the oral Torah, I think, again, I point it out to you, at least it's worth some prayerful consideration and thought processes. So, when it comes to how you kill an animal, I'm perfectly willing to listen to what the sages say and say there's some value to that. The claim that they make, of course, is that when you kill an animal in the fashion that they specify, and without getting graphic, it involves a very, very sharp knife and literally cutting the jugular vein, and the animal bleeds out very quickly. I have seen it done. I've done it. And, it's not without a little bit of trauma. I guess death is like that. But on the other hand, what they tell me is, I haven't experienced it personally, other than watching it, that it is probably about the least bad way to go. Animal doesn't feel much and becomes unconscious very quickly. So it's, if you will, the most humane way of doing it. All right, anyway, my point simply is that there is some value there, and I feel like as we're going through this, I will point that out and say, I'm not completely dismissive of these things. I think when it comes to our understanding of the Torah, it is helpful. Let's let iron sharpen iron. We can talk to one another. I don't dismiss out of hand, but certainly on the other hand, neither do I accept that as a commandment. You know, does that mean I could never shoot an animal if I needed to for hunger and eat an animal that I'd killed with a shotgun or a rifle? See, I don't necessarily accept that either. Anyway, the next few verses talk about the things you can, or how it can be done. How, as the gazelle and as the hart is eaten, you can eat. The hart, H-A-R-T, not the H-E-A-R-T. People who are clean and people who are unclean can eat of these things. But again, it tells us, do not eat the blood. The life is in the blood. You're not to eat the life with the flesh. Pour it out on the earth as water. Do not eat it. You get the idea of this too as being repeated. That it may go well with you and with your children after you. When you do that which is right in the eyes of Yahuwah. Take your burnt offerings, the flesh and the blood, upon the altar. And again, go to the place where he is specifying. Observe, says 28, and hear all of these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and with your children after you forever, so that you do that which is good and right in the eyes of Yahuwah. And when he cuts off these nations before you that you are going in to dispossess, and you do that, you dispossess them and dwell on your land, take heed, one more time, take heed that you are not ensnared to do the same kind of things that they did, to follow after them. Even after they're destroyed from before you, do not, let me say it, I repeat, do not inquire after their gods and say something kind of stupid like this. And here comes the quote. How did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. Now here I pause. And I know it sounds sometimes like I'm bashing on certain traditions, and maybe I am, because Scripture, sure as heck, does, says don't do these things. Well, what, for example, do we see happened during the time of the few hundred years of the common era after the death of Yeshua? The church took it upon itself to say, oh well, as long as we're saving souls for Jesus, or they didn't call him that till 1600 or so. But anyways, we'll just adopt these pagan customs. We'll Christianize them. We'll say it's okay. Hey, that way we can win more souls and bring more people in, and they can keep these cute, harmless customs from drinking blood and sacrificing symbolically or real children, Easter eggs dyed in the blood, and all that kind of clever stuff. What does he say here? He says, do not do that. Verse 31, you shall not do those things unto Yahuwah Eloheka, for every abomination to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which he hates, they have done for their gods. Even their sons and daughters, they burn in the fire to their gods. Nowadays, we just, well, sacrifice them, call it the sacrament of abortion. You know, it's a litmus test if you want to be a black-robed priest of another god and sit on the Supreme Court. How do you feel about the sacrament of abortion? If you don't support it, well, you got no prayer of coming into this particular sanctuary, Mr. Would-Be Justice. And people think, well, we don't have a religious test anymore. For crying out loud, we've got all kinds of things that he calls abomination that are mandated nowadays. Do not do these things, says the end of chapter 12, unto Yahuwah. For every abomination to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which he hates, Ishtar, anyone? Xmas, Mithra, Day, yeah, lots of examples, they have done to their gods. Don't do it. Then chapter 13 begins. Now, this is one of those places, too, it's interesting. If you got a Hebrew Bible, you'll see there's a difference. I normally say this verse that I'm getting ready to read is chapter 12, 32. But I'm looking at a Hebrew English, you know, two-column Bible here, and it puts the verses in the more Hebraic sense. This is actually 13:1. So sometimes that confuses people. Just understand that when you look at a Hebrew Bible or an English Bible, sometimes the verses will be numbered, you know, one or two off from one another. But in anyway, whether it's 12:32 or 13:1, it does say this, and it's the second time we've heard it. All of the things, all of this word, Hadibar, which I command you, you shall observe to do. You are not to add thereto, nor diminish, nor subtract from it. One more time. Don't add to or subtract from my word. It's also, I'll point out to folks, the very last commandment in Scripture. The last commandment in the book of Revelation. Don't add to or subtract from the stuff that is written here. And what is it that men have made literally careers out of doing for thousands, literally thousands of years? Exactly. Doing exactly what is forbidden here. And they do it, a lot of times, in the name of these other gods, adding this wonderful little tradition. Eh, we got that from Weeping for Tammuz. You know, the 40 days of Lent, for example. Not supposed to be doing it, for crying out loud, you're not supposed to be adding to His Word and calling that a commandment. Or telling people not to do certain things. Don't keep His Sabbath anymore, that's done away with. His law is done away with. Those are lies. Chapter 13 is going to give us a little bit more instruction along those very same lines. I think it's a great segue. If there arises in the midst of you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he tries to give you a sign or a wonder, and even if that thing comes to pass, it says that he spoke of you, and then he says something akin to this. Hey, let's go after some other gods which you have not known and serve them. Right? Let's say their birthday is on December 25th, maybe. Or all kinds of things that represent this adding and subtracting in paganism. If some prophet or dreamer of dreams comes to you, in other words, and says, even if the things that he says come true, that therefore we should go worship something different and do different things than the creator of the universe says we ought to be doing, verse 4 tells us what we're supposed to do. Do not hearken. Don't shamar. Don't listen. Certainly don't do what he's telling you to do. For Yahuwah is testing you. You know, he wants to know whether you love Ahav, him or not, with all your heart and with all your soul. And after him shall you walk, and him shall you fear, and his commandments you shall keep, and under his voice you shall hearken, and him you shall serve, and unto him you shall cleave. This verse is interesting because normally it says Yahuwah Eloheka, you see, Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. And in this one, we've got this, in English, capitalized pronoun. First time it gets mentioned, verse 5, after Yod-Heh Vav-Heh Eloheka, all these things you'll do. After him you shall walk, and him you shall fear. His commandments you shall keep. His voice will you listen to. Him you will serve, and unto him you shall cleave. But as for that prophet or dreamer of dreams, whack him. He is to be put to death. Because he has spoken perversion against Yahuwah Eloheka, who brought you out of the land, redeemed you, drew you aside out of the way, which he has commanded you to walk in. So you are to put away the evil from the midst of you. Now, this next section here is another one of those places that people have a real difficult time with nowadays. Let me give you the get out of jail free card, the caveat. Well, we're not in the land, and so we can't quite do this. Oh, see, whoo, you can hear it. Don't have to do that. Okay, but even though we don't whack somebody, it's going to tell you how you're going to do this in a few minutes. But even though we don't do that necessarily, I think the key thing here that we can do is not listen to them, not hearken to them, not follow after them if they're telling us to do things different than Scripture. And then it makes the point in spades by saying this in verse 7, if your brother, the son of your mother, or your son, or your daughter, or the wife that you love, the wife of your bosom, or your friend that's like your own soul. We're talking something akin to David and Jonathan here, blood brothers even. And that person entices you secretly, saying, hey, let's go out and serve some other gods, which you have not known, you nor your fathers. Of the gods of the peoples that are around about you. Like, say, I don't know, the gods in Washington. Or the ones that are got statues all over Vatican City. Folks, the paganism today is so rampant. This is why I emphasize this stuff, and this is why I'm trying to make this as clear. Nothing has changed. We still do the very same things. People will tell us, oh, well, we don't do that nowadays. I don't bow down to a Christmas tree. I don't serve these other things. Abortion is a sacrament, maybe? What are we talking about? We're talking about any number of things, litmus tests, that rise to the level of worship in modern American Western society. They will deny to high heaven, to their high heaven, that these things constitute some kind of worship. I know atheists that'll tell you, essentially, they don't worship anybody. The hell they don't. William Penn had it right. Those who will not serve God will serve tyrants. The things that you've got anthropogenic global warming. There's a religion if there ever was one. We're not going to let the facts stand in the way. Same thing for evolution. We're not going to let the facts stand in the way of the worship. And in some cases, what they're really doing is not so much worshiping one thing as detesting the God of the Bible, but you get the idea. The gods of the peoples that are all around you, or that are far off from you, whether they're close to you or far off from one end of the earth to the other, you are not to consent to such a so-called prophet, nor hearken, nor obey him, in other words. Neither shall your eye pity him, neither shall you spare him, neither shall you conceal him. You're to kill him. Your hand should be the first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. Stone him with stones that he dies, because he has sought to draw you away from Yahuwah Eloheka, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Are there people today that are seeking to draw your sons, your daughters, away from him? If you don't see that, I guess I'd have to say you're blind. Are there people that are trying to draw us away from the worship of the Creator? That's done away with! There are people in churches, so-called, that are doing the same thing. Do we stone them? No. Again, let me keep emphasizing that. We're not in the land, but we can certainly not listen to them. We can certainly turn away from them. We can certainly not even conceal them. People that are trying to draw us, you, your children, those we love, away from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who brought us all out of bondage, we do not listen to. And when we recognize the things that they're trying to entice us to do. Hey, come on over here. Serve this other God. Don't. All Israel, it says, shall hear and fear and do no more any such wickedness as this in the midst of you. Now, we know the history. Israel failed. So, by the way, did Judah. They did listen. They did hearken. They did go out and do the whoring. And it happened over and over and over again. It's why we're currently in exile. And it's also the same reason why we're seeing the same plagues come back again, I will believe and assert. And then it goes on to say, if you hear tell concerning some of these cities that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has given you to dwell in, saying certain, this verse says, certain base fellows, in my translation here, have gone out from the midst of you and drawn away the inhabitants of the city, saying the same thing. You got whole cities that are buying into this line. Now, it turns out that what is called base fellows in this language, what it really says is B'nai Belial. Certain sons of Belial, Belial, have gone out from the midst, and they've got these whole cities doing the same thing. Of them you shall inquire, make search, diligently ask. And by the way, if this is true and it's certain that such abomination has been wrought in the midst of you, then, wow. If we thought it was bad to think about stoning one person, here's where the Creator is making this as clear as he can. I really hate this stuff. I really hate these idols. I really hate this whole concept of my people being enticed away after other gods. Do you get the idea yet? Smite the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, destroying it utterly. Everything in there and all the cattle with the edge of the sword. Gather the spoil in the midst of it and burn it with fire. Oh, I think he doesn't like this. All the spoil. And it shall be a heap forever. It shall not be built again. And there shall be no one cleave to the devoted thing. Ha cherem. Devoted, meaning devoted to this other god. That Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show you mercy and have compassion upon you and multiply you, just as he sworn to your fathers, when you shall hearken to his voice and to keep all his commandments, which I command you this day to do, that which is right in the eyes of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. I'm emphasizing this, I always do. There are a few chapters in Scripture And I guess long ago, I kind of at least committed the numbers to memory so we can go back and find them. Now, we've, in the last 2 weeks, talked about several of them. Deuteronomy chapter 7, Deuteronomy chapter 12, Deuteronomy chapter 13, that all make it ever so clear how much our Creator loves us and hates with a passion idolatry and everything that is associated with it. Don't salvage the stuff that's on these idols, and for crying out loud, don't bring it into your house. And if somebody tries to entice you to follow after these fake gods, well, for crying out loud, even if you're not in the land, don't listen to him. He hates this stuff. We're looking to go back into the land, not find further reasons for ourselves to be, well, given 7 times 7 times 7 of the curses. Chapter 14. You are the B'nai Yahuwah, Eloheka. You are the children of the Lord your God. Don't cut yourselves. Let's pause there for a second. Don't cut yourselves, nor make any baldness between your eyes for the dead. I know in years past when we've come up with this, people have been kind of surprised. But are you aware just how rampant, I've seen it, more times than I care to think about, among teenagers, younger children even, nowadays, how rampant cutting, and they even got a word, just do a search online for children and cutting. You will find probably thousands, maybe tens of thousands of references, psychological tests. Oh yeah, yeah, this is an epidemic. Kids cutting themselves with razor blades or knives or whatever. Wonder where they got that. Isn't it amazing? They just, tens of thousands, hundreds of, maybe more, kids all getting the same stuff, all hearing the same kinds of, don't worship the creator of the universe. He's not even welcome in our schools. Hey, go after these idols. American Idol. Go after all this various kinds of things that look satanic. Why? Because they are. Follow after those gods. Kind of stuff you're seeing on TV. And how amazing it is that they then want to go right out and do what chapter 14 tells us right after. Don't listen to these people trying to entice you into foreign gods. You're the children of Yahuwah. Don't cut yourselves, nor make baldness between your eyes for the dead. Why? Because you are a set-apart people to Yahuwah Eloheka. And he's chosen you to be his own treasure out of all the peoples on the face of the world, of the earth, Ha'aretz. Interesting. Verse 3. The next part of the chapter, by the way, is going to now repeat. And I won't go into a whole lot of detail here, because it's another good reference. I think most of us that have been through this are familiar with these concepts. I'm going to say it up front. There's food and there's not food. Verse 3 says, you are not to eat any abominable thing. Don't eat it. It's not food. Here are the beasts which you can eat. The ox, the sheep, the goat, the hart, which is kind of like a deer, the gazelle, the roebuck, the wild goat, other animals, some of which I'm not even sure if I can pronounce. The payarg, the pagarg, the antelope, mountain sheep. Key is this. He gives us next an understanding, and most of you probably already remember this. Every beast, everything that walks on four legs, that parts the hoof, I guess sometimes they could walk on two legs too, because monkeys are not food. Neither are people. Neither are certain other things. Anyway, every beast that parts the hoof, in other words, has a cloven hoof, a split hoof, and has the hoof wholly cloven in two, and, keyword here is and, chews the cud. Now, generally, we know nowadays that means it probably has more than one stomach. Chews the cud. Internally regurgitates the food up from one stomach on into the next stomach. It's kind of like a dual processor system. It's processing this food twice or more. So anything that has a cloven hoof and chews the cud among the beasts, that is food. You may eat it. Nevertheless, here it's drawing the logic out for us clearly. I won't belabor it. There are things that only chew the cud but don't have a cloven hoof. Things like the camel, the bunny, the hare, the rock badger. They chew the cud, but they do not have a cloven hoof. They are unclean. They are not food for you. And then you got other things. Now, interestingly, there's just one primary category of other thing in this camp. It is the swine, the pig, the porcine kind. He has a cloven hoof. He parts the hoof, but he does not chew the cud. He is unclean to you. Of them, you're not supposed to eat. Their flesh is not food. Their carcasses, even, you shall not touch. By the way, some of you have probably heard this. I'll just touch on it briefly. There's a Midrash, and I find it at least interesting, that says the key here is you can walk up to any animal, particularly if there's a carcass of it or if you've trapped it or something, and you can see within seconds, does it have a parted cloven hoof or not? You can see it, you know, from a distance many times. But when it comes to does it chew the cud, now you got to watch it. You got to spend a few minutes observing the animal, see what it does. You can't just kill it and immediately say, I know whether it does or doesn't do these things. And the swine has historically been considered particularly deceptive because he looks clean, but he's not. And as it turns out, he's probably, so far as modern science has now been able to tell us, about as unclean as you can get. Almost every disease, flu, pandemic that has ever come through man. Nowadays, we're genetically engineering them, but they still start often with swine flu, and then they graft or DNA modify other things to make a greater bioweapon, more virulent, more deadly. But there's always a little bit of pig in there. Interesting. Don't even touch their carcasses. When it comes to things in the waters, if they have fins and scales, it's food. Doesn't have fins and scales, you are not to eat it. It is unclean. Here are clean birds, too. You can eat clean birds. And essentially, there are a list of things that you're not to eat. Now, in the case of the birds, we do not get a rule of thumb. It has this and this. We're simply given a list instead of birds that you can't eat. They're not food. And I will suggest to you, I'm not going to claim this is gospel. It's just my understanding. And in general, it's as close as I can come to a rule. So if I can't remember the whole list, or if maybe sometimes we're not sure what the Hebrew bird translates into English, this seems to be a reasonable understanding. Okay? Let's go through the list and see if you come to the same conclusion. Things you are not to eat, birds that are not food. The great vulture, the bearded vulture, the osprey, the gleed. I'm not sure what a gleed is. The falcon, the kite, all kinds of ravens. The sea mew, the hawk, the nighthawk. And I skipped over one here, the ostrich. We'll come back to that because it's kind of the exception that proves the rule. Little owl, great owl, horned owl, pelicans, carrion vulture, cormorant, stork, heron. The general concept between most of these birds is these are hunter birds. These are birds that are carrion birds in some cases. In other words, these are birds that, just like pigs do on the land, clean things up. Vultures, hawks, eagles, ospreys. They're birds of prey. Don't eat them. Ostriches, any ostrich farmer can tell you, will eat anything. All the winged swarming things are unclean to you. Don't eat those things. All the winged things that are clean, you can eat. And by the way, anything that dies of itself. We joke about this sometimes, calling it roadkill. But something you find dead in the road or dead on the hillside, why'd it die? I don't know. Let's not eat it. You can sell that stuff to a foreigner, it says. They'll eat it. but you are a set-apart people to Yahuwah or Yahuwah Eloheka. And then it puts this in there, too. Do not see the kid in its mother's milk. We can belabor that and have in past times. This is where the rabbis get the claim that you got to separate milk and meat. And quite frankly, that's another one of those things that's oral tradition that I'm not quite convinced of personally. Tithe from the increase of your seed. Eat before Yod Heh Vav Heh, in the place where he puts his name. All the tithes, if it's too far, then you can turn it into money. When you go up to these Feasts of Ascension, which are getting ready to be described in a minute, you can, the kesef, by the way, again, is money. Turn it into kesef, bind that up in your hand, go to the place where he shall choose. And at that point, what you can do is you can trade your money back for whatever else it is. You've basically converted one animal into money and then gone to the other end of the journey and converted it back. oxen, sheep, or wine, or for strong drink, whatever you're asking for. There you shall eat before Yahuwah, and you shall, here comes again, smeach, rejoice, you and your household. Don't forget the Levites. Every 3 years, in the same year, you bring forth the tithe of your increase laid up within your gates. The Levi, too, the Levite, don't forget. Along with the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, all those folks within your gates, they can come and be satisfied, that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh may bless you in all the work of your hands. Every 7 years, you make a release. This is the Shemitah year. Here's how it's going to work, says verse 2. Every creditor releases the things he's lent to his neighbor. He is not to exact it of his neighbor and his brother, because the release of Yahuwah has been proclaimed. Of a foreigner, you may exact it. In other words, you make a loan to a foreigner, he can still owe it to you. But somebody that's within your gates, that is a brother or a neighbor, basically you forgive that debt. There aren't to be any that are truly needy among you, for Yahuwah will surely bless you in the land that he gives you, if you will hearken, Shema, to the voice of Yahuwah, and do all of the things in this commandment, which Moses says, I command you this day, he will bless you, just as he's promised. You will lend to many nations, but not borrow. You will rule over many nations, but they shall not rule over you. If there's a needy person among you, one of your brothers in the land, you're not to harden your heart, nor shut your hand from your brother, but open your hand unto him, lend to him. In other words, be a cheerful giver. Provide for him that which is sufficient for his need. Lend it to him. But by the way, you know what? Sometimes we can get a little stingy and we can say to ourselves things like verse 9 warns about. Be careful there's not a base thought in your heart saying, oh, hey, isn't it pretty close to the seventh year, the Shemitah year, the year of release? Don't let your eye be evil against your brother so that you decide, no, maybe I'll lend to you in a year and a half from now, but not right now. Because he might cry out to Yahuwah against you, and it would be a sin for you. You are to surely give it to him. Don't let your heart be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing, Yahuwah will bless you. You catch the drift? It's all been worked out for our good. These are for blessing. Give it to him. Honor, help. Lend to your neighbor, to your brother. Even if you're worried that it might not get paid back because this seventh year is at hand. Hey, don't worry, in America we don't do that anymore anyway. We'll steal it. We're not even going to give him kasef. We'll give him fake, filthy lucre, dishonest weights and measure. If we will in fact honor our Creator, he will bless us. For the poor won't ever really cease out of the land, so therefore I command you, open your hand to the poor, to your needy brother in the land. Can I expand a bit on verse 28? Briefly, at the end of every 3 years in the same year, bring forth the tithe. There are some other provisions that are other time intervals, I guess is one way to say it, that are laid out in here. Every 3 years in that year, you bring forth your tithe of your increase, you lay it up within your gates. And that is for the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. They can come and eat and be satisfied. The theme that runs through here, I guess, is fairly consistent. There are things that we give. You've heard the old saying, I guess. It's not quite scriptural, but certainly it is borne out here. The Lord loves a cheerful giver. Verse 12, I think, begins to make this point. If a brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold unto you, we're talking again about bond service as opposed to the cruel bondage or slavery. And a lot of times I'll distinguish what we have in America today, whether people recognize it or not, is cruel slavery. Just ask people, who scares them the most? What federal agency? What three letters breathe terror into the hearts of people? Well, there's plenty of candidates, but IRS probably comes as close to any. Talk about bondage and slavery. Remember, the slaves in Egypt had to give 20% to Pharaoh. I guarantee you, most working stiffs, those that are lucky enough, blessed enough to have a job today, would say 20%. Wouldn't I love if it was only 20%? No, slavery here is worse. And there's so many other aspects. We'll talk about that in the news in a second. But basically what this is talking about, again, is something different. This is the kind of bondage that is associated with working off a debt. If a Hebrew brother, man or woman, be sold to you, they are to serve 6 years. In the seventh year, in the Shemitah year, to let them go for free. Go out from you. Now, here is a repetition. By the way, we've talked about this in the book of Exodus, chapter 21. Also has to do a little bit more detail. Moses is kind of summarizing it here. These understandings concerning this bond service. When you let him go, you are not to turn him out empty-handed. And I don't have time to expound on this at real great length, but it's always been fascinating, this difference. Because the Hebraic concept is, a person that goes into bondage, that is sold to pay off a debt, he makes good on what he owes by serving for up to 6 years. Well, one of the things that the master is supposed to do is to teach this guy or woman how to be a free man, how to live, again, in service to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. The whole concept of here is learn. Learn to walk in obedience to my statutes and judgments, commandments, so that you can be a free man. That's the whole point of bringing you out of bondage by a mighty hand. And it says in verse 14, furnish him liberally. Lavish some gifts upon this person, out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, out of your wine press. Out of those things with which Yahuwah has blessed you, you're to bless them. This verse 15 gives us a clue as to why. Remember, you too were a bondman in the land of Egypt, and Yahuwah redeemed you. Therefore, I command you to do this thing today. Now, verse 16, again, harkens back to Exodus 21. It shall be, if this person says to you, I won't go out. Hey, I love you. I love being a servant, a slave to you. I love your house, because he's fared well with you. All right, then, take an awl, thrust it through his ear into the door. At least one teaching that I saw in the last few days points out, isn't it interesting? Again, we're seeing blood on the door. He is to be your bond person, bondman forever. And same thing goes for your bond woman. But that's not what the nominal condition is supposed to be. And verse 18. Says this. Now, at this point, I want to pause and give credit where credit is due. I saw an interesting presentation from Rabbi David Foreman, another one of those guys that I really like. I like his style. I like the way his thought processes work. And he points out a number of the similarities that you'll see, of course, with this whole idea of bond service and coming out of Egypt. And I won't go through all of that. But the thing that he brought up that I thought was kind of interesting is, long before modern psychology named this concept the Stockholm Syndrome. The Stockholm Syndrome, remember, is where the captive begins to identify with his captor. You saw it with the Patty Hearst case years ago. She became a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army. You got modern situations, people being taken captive by Islamic terrorists or whatever, and eventually they cave. I guess people work in Washington, too. They become victims of the Stockholm Syndrome if they stay there too long. Well, anyway, verse 18 is the Creator's remedy for that. Literally, we're talking again about bondage and about people that are supposed to learn how to live as free men. The idea is that the nominal case is they're not supposed to say to you, I love my slavery. Who loves their slavery? Well, we got lots of people on welfare that are being conditioned nowadays to love their servitude and their service to another master. To him they shall cleave. That's not the way it's supposed to be. It's not the kind of freedom that Torah is written to pursue. Verse 18 says, it shall not seem too hard to you when you let this person go free from you. For to the double of the hire of a hireling, he served you for 6 years. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh will bless you in all that you do. Lavish these gifts upon this person. It's not to be hard. What is it supposed to be? Literally, it's supposed to be joyful. There's that theme again. Back to the Stockholm Syndrome. Why does David Foreman say this is the Creator's remedy for the Stockholm Syndrome? Well, because part of the idea here is you want this person to stay free. We're going to lavish gifts on them. We're going to celebrate this day of your freedom. It's going to be a joyful time, and the point is you're going out free. You're going to be set up. You've got some animals here. You got some food, a little bit of wine. You got the things you need. Now, come on, bro. Go out and live as a free man. Follow Torah. Walk in the blessings. Let's be joyful for this. Firstling males, born of your herd and your flock, they're to be set apart. You're to eat those things before Yahuwah, year by year in the place that he chooses, you and your household. Once again, if there are blemished animals, lame animals or whatever, those aren't to be sacrificed. Eat it within your gates. Clean and unclean people can eat of it. Only you shall not eat the blood. Pour that on the ground like water. That brings us to chapter 16, where it's going to once again reprise for us the various Hagim, the feast, the appointed times. Shalosh Regalim is the one of the Hebrew terms that appears here. Pilgrimage festivals is one way to translate that, or the feasts of ascension. These three of the appointed feasts of Yod Heh Vav Heh, again, they're not Jewish feasts. We love our Jewish brethren, and I don't have a real problem with that label, other than it tends to be used by people who don't know any better to say, oh, those are Jewish feasts, those aren't Christian. Well, excuse me. No offense, they are not Jewish. They are the feasts of Yod Heh Vav Heh. There's his feast. He's the one tells us to keep these things. Yeah, Jews keep them. Yeah, there are other people that keep them too, and includes all of us who actually love him and are called according to his purposes and try to walk in his blessings. If we love him, we keep his commandments, and that includes his feasts. And we can't do these things because there's not this place right now where he's put his name, at least not so far as there's a mishkan or tabernacle upon it. But it does tell us in chapter 16 what the three feasts are. Observe the month of Abib. Keep the Passover. For in the month of Abib, he brought you out of Egypt. Sacrifice the Passover offering in the place that he causes his name to dwell. Again, can't do that. But we can do at least a memorial about the unleavened bread part. 7 days, eat unleavened bread, the blood of friction. There's to be no leaven in your borders, nor shall any of the flesh which you sacrifice remain all night until morning. You may not sacrifice the Passover offering within any of your gates. Again, we're outside the place. The place where he chooses his name, that's where it should be done. At the point where we see that happening again, perhaps we can look forward to those kind of things. You will roast it and eat it in the place he chooses. 6 days, again, eat the unleavened bread. And then we start numbering for the Feast of Weeks. 7 weeks. This is 7 times 7 plus 1. Keep the Feast of Weeks. Shavuot. Some people will refer to that as Pentecost. And then again it says rejoice. There's that word, Sameach, before Yahuwah. You, your son, your daughter, your maidservant, your manservant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, all those folks in the midst of you, in the place that he shall cause his name to dwell. Remember, you are a bondservant. And then finally it tells us this, keep the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. After you've gathered in your grain from the threshing floor and the things from your winepress, rejoice in that feast. All those same folks, son, daughter, manservant, maidservant, Levite, stranger, fatherless, widow, within your gates. 7 days. Keep that feast. Because Yahuwah, Eloheka, shall bless you in all your increase and in the work of your hands, and you shall be altogether, say it with me, joyful. 3 times in a year, all the males are to go up to this place that he has chosen. Those 3 times, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and Sukkot, Feast of Tabernacles. Don't appear empty-handed. Every man shall give as he's able, according to the blessing which he has showered upon you. And that takes us to the end of the Parsha. A lot of interesting stuff. Some of it, again, repetition. Much of it, things that we've heard before, because it's important. And one of the things that I think this theme continues to cycle through here, it's, to my mind, really helpful. Particularly when you go through a portion like this to compare and contrast to the things we've been taught that just aren't so, things we've heard said that aren't quite right. Those are Jewish feasts, don't keep them. Well, the Creator of the universe says do keep them. We can't so much keep them in the way that we used to once upon a time because there are some aspects that we can't do. But we can certainly memorialize them. We can certainly try the very best we can to walk in a way that is pleasing in His sight. And for crying out loud, we can avoid replacing the things He says to keep, things that He says don't, for crying out loud, don't do. Because there's a snare, there's a trap there. And that's the long and the short of the things that are made so clear in portions like this one.